What up, folks? This episode of the Smoking Tire Podcast is brought to you by JB Weld, home of the world's strongest bond. You've heard of JB Weld before. It's like it's like a verb. It's like the strongest thing you can put on your car, your project, whatever. Pros have turned to JB Weld for over 50 years. But why even bother hiring a pro when JB Weld's adhesive products make it so easy to do it yourself? Whether you're talking about a DIY project at home, an automotive repair, plumbing, marine, or more, for projects big and small, at home or in your garage, JB Weld is what's up. In fact, JB Weld products can be used on practically anything: metal, wood, plastics, glass, ceramics, and more. Keep it handy in the toolbox, keep one in the kitchen drawer, and keep one in the back of the car. You never know when you're going to need it. Speaking of the back of the truck, JB Weld just acquired Herculiner, the original DIY truck bed liner. So if you're looking for the world's strongest truck bed liner, Herculiner's got you covered there. You can use it on boats, use it on stairs, and in fact, I am planning to use the Herculiner they sent me on the shop floor here at the garage. I'm going to make a fake carpet out of Herculiner in the lobby, like a pattern. I'll make a pattern with tape and then roll the Herculiner down.
Yeah.
So there'll be like a pattern in bed liner on the floor. It'll be very cool.
You can use it for like a non-stick surface on stairs.
Exactly. Like yeah. Non-slip. Go be your strongest self. Use JB Weld, the world's strongest bond. It is available at, are you ready for this, j-bweld.com, Walmart, Amazon, Home Depot, Lowe's, AutoZone, Advance Auto Parts, Napa, O'Reilly, Michaels, and more. JB Weld epoxy products are proudly made in the USA, and it is the world's strongest bond. So check it out at all of those places. We're also brought to you by Policy Genius. Policy Genius is America's leading online insurance marketplace. The mission is to help people get insurance right by making it easy for them to understand their options, compare quotes, and buy a policy all in one place. Policy Genius can help you find home and auto coverage similar to what you have now, but at a much lower price. They save customers an average of $1,250 per year over what they were paying for home and auto insurance. Their team will handle the paperwork to set up your new policy or switch over your current one. Getting started is super easy. Just go to policygenius.com, answer a few quick questions about yourself and your property. Then Policy Genius takes it from there. They compare rates from America's top insurers, from Progressive to Allstate, to find your lowest quotes. The Policy Genius team can look for ways to save you more, including bundling your home and auto policies. If they find a better rate than what you're paying now, they will switch you over for free. Their top-notch service has earned Policy Genius an excellent rating on Trustpilot. So head over to policygenius.com right now to get started, because Policy Genius, when it comes to home insurance, it's nice to get it right. Now, let me talk to you about these Raycon earbuds. I'm supposed to read this ad, but I don't even have to really read it because they sent me the Raycons to use. And the other day, it's them on the left, the little blue joints. I had to drive the red car, the Lamborghini, up to Donnie's in the middle of the desert. The car, the stereo is just not there. Like, it's there, but it's not like the for one reason or another. Earbuds are the way to go in this car. And I like listening to a V12 like anybody else, but on a highway trip, give me some music, give me a podcast, let me get lost in the zone. You know what I mean? So I threw in the Raycons, I charged them up in this nice little kind of egg-shaped, you know, case they come in, plugged them in overnight, fully charged, threw them in my ears, pressed the power button, and there they were on my phone in the Bluetooth menu, clicked to connect, and boom, Raycons going.
They
connected.
Sync super fast.
They
really
synced
easy.
Super yeah. fast. I then, like, kind of, I was walking around a shop with them in my ears, and I left my phone and I walked away from them, and it was like, bloop, Raycon disconnected. And then when I walked back up to my phone, it was like, bloop, Raycon connected. So it did the thing.
Yeah.
And then I listened to the new episode of The Dollop all the way up to Donnie's. Nice, loud, and clear. And, you know, unlike some other earbuds I've tried where they fall out of my ears, a certain computer and phone manufacturers wireless earbuds, they just don't stay
in
my ears.
They don't work in my ears either. Yeah.
I did a 90-minute car ride out to the desert. no adjustments, zero, just in the ear, and there they set.
Yeah,
they come with a bunch of different size little rubbery guys that you can interchange to make it fit your ear really well. And honestly, I got crisp, powerful beats. I got clear voices in the podcast. I had a call with my wife. Worked nice. They come in different colors. And quick and seamless Bluetooth pairing. A very compact charging case. And they last a long time. You know, I used them on that whole trip. I used them on the whole drive home. And they still had plenty of battery left. Very cool. And I'm using an Apple device. And they integrated with an Apple device quickly, easily, and utterly painlessly. So listen up. Raycon is offering 15% off all of their products for my listeners. And here's what you got to do to get it. Go to buyraycon.com/smoking. There you will get your 15% off the entire Raycon order. And it's such a good deal, you'll want to buy a pair and a spare. 15% off at buyraycon.com/smoking. That's buyraycon.com/smoking. We are also brought to you by my favorite, the most delicious, the most scrumptious, the stickiest of the ickiest, Tradecraft Farms. Whether it's CBD you're looking for, or whether you just want to go for the full bore, high powered brute force THC, Tradecraft Farms has you covered. If you are in one of these civilized places where these things are perfectly legal, then ask for it in your dispensary or visit one of their retail locations throughout the California area. If you are not somewhere where it is so civilized that you can walk into a store and purchase these items on a credit card, give them a follow on Instagram. They got a fun little Instagram going. Great up-close shots of beautiful, sticky, icky. You feel me? They got the solid gold joints. They got the rose petal thing. I mean, it's all crazy down there. They're doing weird, funky science, and the ganja banaka is coming out soon, too. It's ridiculous! Tradecraft Farms is the official cannabis provider of the Smoking Tire podcast, and it still makes me smile every time I get to say that. On this episode of the Smoking Tire podcast, the know-it-all himself, Jason Camisa, is in the house. He's got the beautiful new film for the Haggerty Channel he wants to talk about, as well as we're talking about the new BMW M3 and M4, which he's had lots of time in, and we're going a little BTS action with some of the logistics involved in making some of these more difficult films, and of course Jason has his many opinions, and we go to the audience to pick random numbers from his spreadsheet to review random cars from his past. Haggerty's Jason Camisa is on the Smoking Tire podcast. Dude, I watched your newest Icons video. You sent me the cut.
Thank you.
I can't even call it a video because it's 30 minutes long. It's proper television length.
Yeah.
I mean, even if it was a half hour on TV, it would only be 22 and a half. So it's like 29:40.
The first thing I need to do is publicly apologize to my editor, who has said, wow, that M3 cut was the longest year of my life.
Yeah.
He's not thrilled with me. But it needed to be done. So for the record, that episode goes out next Thursday, which is June 10th. So no one else has seen it yet. You two got a preview of it, so we can talk about this because I know you have feelings about the M3.
Wait, so we can or we can't talk about it?
We can't.
I mean,
okay,
yeah.
We're not going to scoop you.
It's not. We don't even need to talk about like what you think about the fucking M3. Like, it's not even about that. I was really impressed with your filmmaking. I mean, that was really the intro shot. The first like 35 seconds or 60 seconds, whatever it is, of that film is as good as I've seen in years from anybody.
Yeah.
As far as a fucking Scorsese level shot. That was very, wow. Very good.
Timed reveals. Very good.
It was very, very good.
That was credit due to my director, as always, Anthony, who came up with this intro sequence and thought, let's do the world's longest burnout. So the one thing I'm not sure that is quite apparent, I don't think we nailed, is that entire scene was a burnout, and the burnout was approximately a mile long.
Oh, yeah, did not know it was burnout the whole time.
You didn't?
No, I knew it started with one, but then I thought he was just driving past.
Oh,
the
other
no. I knew, told him.
The tires stopped smoking after a while, and you kind of had to look for it.
Because
they
were on the cords. Yeah. So the thing was, funny, Anthony and I agree on almost everything except for when we're fighting like brothers. And on that one, I'm like, we need a drone shot to show the aerial of those fucking skid marks.
You know what? Like, it's a missed opportunity, but I don't know if what the cost of a drone for that one shot would have been.
It was there.
It was.
Oh, well, then there's no excuse.
Yeah, we just didn't need it. We didn't use it. It was all, look, it was all good, but it was like a mile long burnout. Of course, chopped up into like 2 half-mile segments. We did it a couple times, but
no, you did. Christ. You really did. Like, it was a pretty strong 45-second monologue, timed perfectly with multiple drifting other vehicles crossing paths while doing a very well controlled brake stand. It was good.
Yeah,
it was really, really, really good. It was like I watched the first 45 seconds and I stopped it to text him that was very good.
Yeah.
Like, wow. And that doesn't happen. I don't like anything.
That's also true.
and me neither, which is why I don't like anything or anyone, which is why we get along, Matt.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, thank you guys.
That's why you, me, and Christian are a good triangle.
Wow, he hates everyone too, doesn't
yeah.
he? That explains it. I mean, I literally have it on my license plate, which is on my shirt right now. Is I hate everyone is my license plate on the Lotus.
I mean, it's a little trite, like that anti-social social club shirt, but like maybe we should just have like a people who hate everyone club.
Here's the thing. It's not that I hate everyone permanently. It's that you start on a minus 10 to plus 10 scale with me. You start with a minus 9.7. And you have to
you being everybody.
Your way up from there. You being everyone. Everyone I meet. I don't like you right off the bat. I fucking hate people. I fucking hate you. And, you know, like, Christian's one of those people that I'm, what the fuck is he doing? We met on a photo.
Wait, who is Christian?
Doing?
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah.
Go ahead.
We met on a photo shoot. It was one our art director's friend from college, and we needed one more body. And I'm like, oh, who's this asshole going to be? Within 10 seconds, he was like from minus 9.7 all the way up to minus 4. And then within, by the end of the day, it was like happily in like plus 0.3 category.
Yeah.
What does the scale go up to?
10 is where his scale goes. Like,
it goes from negative 10 to 10.
The best you could be in his book is like a 4. Like a 4 is like a perfect
three.
Humanitarian
for Jason. I mean, let me just be honest for a second.
You know, we need to get Jason the stupid book.
Yes.
Did you see the stupid book? Mm-hmm. Is it still on my desk? Why do I keep blanking on the goddamn name of the stupid book? It's like the 5 basic rules of human stupidity or something like that. And when you read it, it'll just fucking, you'll just rewire it. You'll start putting everybody on the chart. It'll all make sense.
The basic laws of human stupidity.
You need to get this book. And if you don't have it already, I'll send it to you. It's like 70 pages. You'll read it in 3 dumps. And it is fan-fucking-tastic. And it's got these charts. Oh, pull up the chart. So you can plot everybody. And by their actions on this chart that has quadrants.
Oh, fuck. Do I now need to have another spreadsheet?
For
like
people?
One for each car and then one for each person?
Yes.
And then like spider charts for like where people sit on the asshole. Oh, no.
Yes, you do.
What have you done to me?
By the way, that reminds me, our favorite activity with Jason is to call out random numbers from his spreadsheet and have him relive random cars. So, Jason, have the spreadsheet in the background. And in the super chat, we'll take requests. It's what, 0 to 1500? Is that what it is? Something like that? 0 to 1200?
No, Matt, hold on. Let me look at 0 to, or it's technically like, it's 1 through, hold on. The Hyundai Tucson that's being picked up today is 2561.
Fuck me. All right. In the super chat, and we'll choose, I'm a straight up capitalist, this bitch, by donation amount. The highest donation amounts will take priority in choosing numbers 1 through 2,500 for Jason to randomly review cars from his past. So we'll have that'll be our super chat activity today. We're going to capitalism the fuck out
of
this.
I like how you can capitalize on this. Where's my fucking
I'll guy? Split. You want to cut? I'll fucking cut you in, bro.
Okay.
Just I'll, straight up. My word is bond. But word is bond, cash money. I will cut. We will cut Kamisa in 50% from
finally,
today's haul.
I have
haul.
Found a way to make money on the internet.
Here we go. But this film, your filmmaking is amazing. Your driving, Randy's driving in it is really great. Your script writing.
Big secret, Randy.
Oh, God damn it. Did I? Do you want me to undo that one?
No, it's totally fine. No, it's totally fine.
And we're gonna air this episode the same day as his show goes up on Thursday.
So only 245 people.
The reason that I gave you guys the early view is the preview, even though it's not done, is that I wanted you guys to be able to see it, so we can talk about it. So nothing's off limit. But I did kind of think I can't do a review of an M3 and M4 and drive them both again, like I drove the Supra, Supra and Z4 the last time. That was a pain in the ass to do all the stunt driving myself. We had five cars on this episode.
There were a bunch, old cars and new cars.
And let me revise that old Hollywood thing. You know, they always say never work with kids or animals.
Yeah.
Can I add old cars into
old
that?
Old cars. welcome to my life. Hi, nice to meet you. Matt Farah. Yeah, I drive people's home-built fucking cars.
Oh, my God. Well, here's the issue. Let me add not just old cars, but then old cars that you own.
So, oh, yeah. That's what I didn't want to do that reveal if that was going to be it. But, like, since you just said it.
All right. 240 people keep your mouth shut. But here's the deal. You can't talk about the M3 and why every journalist in the world is like, I'm not sure this new M3 is actually an M3. And it happens every time there's a new one. We all say the same shit. Me too. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of thought about, like, why do we all hold this car to this unattainable standard? And then I realized that there are just different M3s that have happened, right? The E30 stands alone as a homologation race car. E36, E46 was a very different type of car. That was a streetable car that made financial sense, but that, you know, gave you all the charms of a race car with none of the real drawbacks. And then E90 and F80 were just M5s with an M3 back on it. And so I sort of divided them into those three, and I'm like, you can't tell the story of our expectations for an M3 without going back and talking about the fact that the E30 was a very different car. And if you're going to talk about the E30, you need to explain to people why that car existed in the first place. And no one seems to know that story except for people who follow my Instagram, because I'm an idiot and I never shut up about it. So I had the spark that created the M3 explosion was the Mercedes 190 2.316. And so I had my 2.316 there and my very good friend Bill's wife's E30 M3, both of which are Concours winning cars. Like, these are perfect. So there's no pressure or anything for us not to fuck them up and not, like, damage them and crash them and whatever.
And they weren't being driven slowly.
Well, so this is like no good plans laid. What is that? Whatever. No
best
whatever.
Laid plans yeah. of.
Yeah, all get fucked up. That's exactly how that turned out. And so Bill puts Tate's car on the lift. He's at the BMW shop in San Rafael. He's like the god. I call him Tate Bill, but he's just nationally known sort of BMW mechanic. So he puts the E30 on one lift. I put the 2316 on the other lift. And we spent the whole weekend working on the cars. We fixed everything that we knew that was broken on it. Just kind of went through, did bolt checks, made sure everything was absolutely perfect. And the first thing that happened is the ABS broke on my Mercedes. On the way to the track. And this is a car that has not broken in the 90s. Like, I've done 1,000-mile rallies in it. I've beat the shit out of it. And of course, the second, the reason the ABS broke is because at full droop, the wheel, the ABS wire is like, too short, and it broke one of the wires to the wheel speed sensor.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had it up on the lift so many freaking times.
That sucks.
So that gave the M3 the idea that it should break, which then made the Mercedes go, hold my fucking Wachstein up, yeah. And which made the BMW go, watch this motherfucker. And it started this competition between these two cars that is perfectly on brand for the, oh my God. So in the middle of one of the scenes, like it's bad enough that I'm the writer and I'm the producer and I'm the executive producer. And I'm like, and then I'm on camera trying not to have like greasy fingernails and looking like a fucking fat, old, greasy fingered asshole. The fucking Mercedes snapped
you don't
the throttle
look old,
cable
don't
in the middle of a drift. So I have Randy drifting the Mercedes toward me while I'm sitting on a line. Wah, bah, bah, bah. And he just goes right by. I'm like, why was it silent and on the radio? Either your motor just blew or I think I broke a throttle cable.
Wow, that's a very good. That was a very good Randy impression.
Thank you.
You really had. You fucking nailed that. That's good. You guys spent a lot of time together. That's.
Yeah. No, Jason. So then you hear just Anthony the director go. fuck, and like just complete silence. So now I'm like, it's 104 degrees outside. I'm under the hood of the car, rigging a throttle cable out of zip ties. And yikes. Anthony's like, we're fucked. And Randy's like, oh, you know, I really hope I didn't screw up that scene. And I'm just like, somebody get me gloves. And so now next take, I'm covered in sweat. I'm covered in grease. I'm like, I hate my life. I hate the job, but we got it. We got the shot.
Was that shot at the beginning of the day, end of the day? Like, did you still have to do the track driving in that car afterwards?
Second shot of the whole episode.
Oh, my amazing. God, really? You had to shoot the whole fucking rest of that thing with a zip-tied throttle?
It worked.
Wow.
My
yikes.
Zip tie skills are second to none.
Zip ties are incredibly strong.
Like, I mean,
they
yeah,
are very
I know,
strong.
But yeah. I wasn't thinking it was going to snap again. I was thinking about, like, the extra amount, you know, throttles. You're gonna drift the fucking car, you know. You don't want a lot of fucking flex in your throttle. Yeah. Like, that's not what
I feel
want.
Like every 17-year-old 240SX owner right now is going, dude, it works.
It works. I mean, I had like five structural zip ties with a whole bunch of backups. So, I mean, It was really rigid.
Yeah.
It worked. The ABS was really fun watch. So, of course, we have Randy set a lot of time on the cars, right? This is why he's there, because he's a friggin' machine. So I warn him, I'm like, I give him the keys to the Mercedes first, and I'm like, okay, dude, ABS lights on, so no ABS. If you cycle the key over 50, it comes back on, but then it turns off when it wants to. I don't know, sorry. And dog leg, go. That's all I tell him. He comes back in, or he goes out, and he does a warm-up lap, and he comes back in. He's like, oh, that car is really well-balanced. I didn't expect that. I'm like, yeah, go. So we go out, and just we hear, and he just keeps going, flies by us with one wheel locked up for like 300 feet. I'm like, those are literal brand new tires. which I should say, by the way, in this lap time comparison, I called Fredestein, who makes the 205 5515, which is the original size for both cars.
Yeah, I'm like, hey, the Jaro design shit, right? With the cool side.
No,
balls,
this
right?
is their Sprint Plus. Oh. So it's not the Jaro one, but. But they sent me two sets of identical tires, and this is, you know, I wanted this to be as fair as humanly possible. So of course Randy comes back in, and he always sets his fast lap first. It's always his fast lap. He comes back in, and I'm like, okay, I just need to know. I'm not telling you what your lap time was, but I need to know how much that ABS slowed you down. And he was like, one corner going into the decreasing radius left, I 0.2, maybe 0.3 seconds. Otherwise, I got it. I'm like, motherfucker, that would have slowed me down by 11 seconds, and I would have crashed into a fucking wall. Because it did. He did cycle the key on the front straight, and he did go from in mid ABS to no ABS in the middle of a decreasing radius braking zone at 100 miles an hour. So typical Randy is like, oh yeah, no, I had to overslow a little bit because of that. Totally fine. So then he goes out in the E30. And we just hear him roaring down the straight. And next thing, he hits the curb on the inside. And we hear this horrible whack. And it was the suspension bottoming out because the the bump stop broke in half. And when he hit it, we found out later. And then just sort of either coil bound it or just broke the shock. And so now the E30 had a broken shock.
Oh my
so
God.
The front end does this the whole time. And so we're watching him go by, and I'm like, oh no.
Let me
oh
just
no. All of
explain
this,
that this is exactly why I say no to anybody who wants to make a fucking video with my car. People ask me all the time. I go, hell to the no. And this is
what
why.
What we do to these cars is horrible. I mean, look, it's not horrible. It's just any weakness in the car will be exposed like that. It's
instantly.
Instantly. And this is, you know, the M3 was dead stock. So both cars are on 30-something-year-old shocks, 30-something-year-old springs, and 30-year-old bushings. And but he,
your
you
car
know,
has
the,
original
so
shocks on it?
Oh, yeah. My car's original brake pads.
What? How many miles are in the car?
50. But 50,
seems
000.
Like it's probably time to do brake pads, doesn't it?
But you seem to drive
after that
lot.
Track day, I think maybe it might be.
They're still okay. I mean, of course, I've had to do ABS and everything's fixed again, but it was an old lady car.
I bet you that car has the same, like my Ferrari, Lamborghini, and Porsche all have the same brakes. The same. Like same old Bosch fucking whatever the fuck it is. I bet your car's got the same shit too.
This is actually the same brakes as E30. It's a Girling caliper. It's the same ABS pump between the two cars. There's a lot of, I mean, it's all the same. You know, there's only so many supplies.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
All three of my cars are the same injection system, too. They've all got the Bosch CIS.
Yeah, exactly. Bosch CIS. You
Everybody, Donnie part. Opened the hood. He's like, oh, shit. No worries. Here we go.
Yeah, same shit. So anyway, Randy comes back in, and I'm like, all right, how much off of your lap time were you? He was like, 0.5. So whatever it was, we did the math, and at his worst and best confidence intervals, one of the cars still had a lead, so we're calling it a valid result, and that's it. So we will have the first ever stock E30 M3 versus stock Eurospec 2316 lap challenge, which is really fun.
What do you mean first ever? It was done in period.
I've never seen it done. Nope.
Never done in period? So, nobody races cars in the 80s? Times.
I mean, DTM, yeah, but never the street cars. I've never found anyone do the street cars. And the interesting thing was all of the instrumented tests, because the Mercedes came 3 years earlier than the M3. The Mercedes was on P6 and the M3 was on P600s, which were a full generation of tires newer. Yeah. But still, the skid pad numbers were within 1/100th, and the usually the M3 was like 0.81, and the Mercedes was 0.80 or whatever. And then the slalom numbers were identical, and the braking numbers, the Mercedes had a lead. And I thought, you know what? With identical rubber on it, these cars should, the Mercedes, I thought, would be faster in corners, and the BMW is this much faster in a straight line. The cars weighed within 12 pounds of each other. I weighed them both.
Wow.
Yes. So with the same tires within 12 pounds of each other and 185 PS versus 195 PS. So 10 German horsepower difference.
So back in the day, none of the magazines, were they just not able to get both cars at once because of manufacturers like didn't want them to, or did just
in the US, the US 2.16 had three catalytic converters, reduced compression than different cans on. So plus they loaded it with power seats and all kinds of other stuff. So it weighed over 3,000 pounds. It just wasn't the same.
That's and yours is a European car.
Mine's a European car.
Hmm. I've driven a US spec, and then I drove one that guy made European spec, and they are completely different cars.
Totally
100% different cars.
Yeah.
The US ones feel like shit, basically.
And well, I drove the light US ones one. Feel it great. Sucked.
Yeah, the light ones, they feel like a good E30. Ew. Yeah. Sorry, continue, Jason.
Yeah, no. So the German, I don't know of any German lap challenges. I mean, they all tested the 2316 in 84 and 85. Uh-huh. And then by the time the M3 came out, it was 87, 88.
Yeah.
So it was a long time away, and the cars already out of production.
I guess. But they were racing each other, though.
They were racing each other, yeah. So okay. the story there was that you'll see explain the video that the Mercedes didn't do a factory backed effort until
right, the yeah, came yeah. In the oh, and they were doing the Evos. The Evos were the fact. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so the regular cars have homologation. Both the 2016 non-cat car and the M3 original M3 have DTM homologation, or I should say FIA homologation. And then, but it wasn't, the Mercedes wasn't a factory backed effort until the 88 season. And they had a 2.560 at that point. So it's.
We had one of those here. We just sent it away. It was very cool.
The Evo 2, right?
Yeah. The Evo 2 with the big wang.
So crazy.
It turns out cover companies don't stock covers for those. Yeah, it turns out you have to get those custom made.
It's a win.
Yeah, there's an upcharge for the extra million yards of fabric you need to cover that enormous wing.
The thing that had like, it had like no miles on it. It was extremely, it was the coolest thing to look at ever. I drove it for a minute, and it would be the coolest $50,000 car ever. The fact that it was $250,000 makes it mildly disappointing for what it is, but it looks amazing.
The problem with the Evo 2s is they got so expensive that the early, I'll say in the round, because there's a 2316 original, then the cat car, and then a 2516 Evo 1 and the Evo 2. And if I rank them all from best to worst to drive, the Evo is right at the top, but directly below it is the early car. And I drove Evo 2 back to back with my car. It's not much faster. It's maybe 0.3 of a second quicker to 60. Instead of 7,100, it revs to 77. I mean, it's cammier, sounds a little better, and it feels like my car would feel if it had shocks and springs on it, like stiffer shocks and springs.
It just looks way fucking cooler. It looks mean as fuck.
Yeah,
it's the fucking dope. Before we put the cover on that car, everybody who saw it was like, what the fuck is that?
It looks much better than the E30. It just looks interesting from every angle. It looks tough as fuck.
Yeah.
And I mean, I like the E30, but it just, The Mercedes is better looking.
Jason, my favorite E30 is not the M3. It's the 325 IS. Am I crazy?
I own two 325 I's, and I don't own an M3, and I never have. I've owned every body style of 325i, but never a M3. So part of the hard part about this video is I got to be objective, right? It doesn't matter what I think, right? This is, you know, we're trying to be objective and trying to tell a story here, and I hate that M3. It's the motor. That motor is just
BMW is not known for its four cylinders. It's not BMW's thing, and the four-cylinder engine.
And also, they are so known for that straight six. That M20, that straight six, is one of the smoothest and best-sounding engines ever made.
Yeah.
So you go from one of the smoothest, best-sounding engines of all time to, I don't even understand how that S14 makes any power once it's done vibrating itself apart. Like, there's just, holy shit.
Yeah, it's not great.
So, I mean, I have an M3 because of the way it looks, but I don't. About
we looks, did a so. We did a BMW film in South Carolina like 7 years ago at Spartanburg, and I got to have a long go in the E28 M5, which in this day and age is small enough that it feels, you know, old and compact and the right size, but still like super spacious inside, and it's got like the best engine ever, the high winding cammy ass straight six, so it actually has like torque exiting a corner. Like, you can accelerate at under 60.
It's a great car.
The best.
Really great car.
The best.
Soft and civilized, too.
Oh, yeah. Lovely.
Jason, is there any structural difference between an 89 325 IS and an M3? I mean, I know you know there's like aero changes and body changes, but like the Integra Type R, they added more metal here and took it away there. Did they do any of that with the E30s?
It was built in reinforcements. So, I mean, they did things like bonding in the glass, but I think until the Evo cars, it was mostly the same chassis with just some additional reinforcement.
Wow.
I think they were the same, but I could be wrong on that. The glass was bonded. Obviously the rear window cap was a complete aero change, and there was a structural benefit to that too. But I'm pretty sure the structure is the same. You can take a 325i, put a Speccy 30 suspension on it, and it'll outrun an M3 all day. It's mostly kind of off-the-shelf parts.
And the engines are so good.
The engines are a good time. Yeah. This, I mean, if you're going to be driving an old BMW, like, you want a six-cylinder. It's just like, it sounds better. Yeah. It's more fun.
Feels better.
It makes more power. Yeah. It's great. The new cars, Los Del Beaver Teeth. We drove an M4 non-competition stick, and then we drove an M3. We drove the pearl white coupe, non-comp stick, and then we drove a sedan in fucking Brazil.
Right, and I just drove a sedan manual non-comp 2 days ago.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. What were you? You had two modern M cars in this film. What were they?
So the same thing as you did. I had an M4 stick base, and then a M3 competition sedan. And the M4 was so fucking ugly, we decided not to film with it.
That's hysterical. Is it only used in that one shot?
It's used, yeah. So we got a lap time.
I'll be honest, I didn't have all 30 minutes to watch it. I watched the part about the old cars, and then I watched the intro shot, and then I had to go do my job. And I figured we'd talk about the rest here. So you'll forgive me, but is it only really used in that one shot? Because that would be very funny.
It's the intro shot, and then we got a lap time with it.
That's hilarious.
But the thing is, look, I sort of half-cheated BMW. I wanted to make sure, I asked them for a stick, because I always prefer the stick. And they said, okay, we can give you, there was a whole bunch of reasons, but they're like, we can give you an M4 with a stick. And I'm like, I really don't like the way the 4 Series looks. And then it was yellow with blue interior. And I'm like, oh God, all I'm going to do is make fun of this fucking thing. So I'm like, hey, give me an M3 comp at the same time, because I think the sedan looks better. And
I agreed.
At least not make fun of it the entire time. And so I drove the M4 stick for a week beforehand, and I thought it was okay. And then I hopped in the M3 comp, and I'm like, fuck it, we're revising the entire script. We're not even mentioning that coupe. The comp is, I thought, a world better than the base car. And I hope you agree.
I don't know about a world, but I think Zach and I agreed that the sedan, The car makes sense. A car that size makes way more sense with four fucking doors. It just, it makes no sense to have a car that gigantic with two doors. Whether it's a Hellcat or a fucking BMW, it just doesn't matter.
You know, the thing, M4 is only 2 inches shorter than the M8.
Dude, it's we did similar massive math, and the M4 is the size of the fucking V10 M6, which is silly. It's just enormous. Dumb. Yep. To have a car that takes up that much space
and but has like so little usable space inside.
So little space and giant doors.
Yeah.
Like, I hate a giant door. It drives me fucking nuts to have a giant door.
It has to be on a car, I think, that costs more money and is from a different class, honestly.
Oh, if on it's a Phantom, you know, yeah, I'll take give me a big door. Give me a 9-foot door with a button on the Phantom.
But and, like, and the proportions of the sedan and the coupe, they look totally different. The trunks look different.
Yeah.
Like the profile view of one versus the other, they look like completely different cars instead of just like where the whereas like the E36 coupe and the E36 coupe and sedan, they don't look that dissimilar.
Right.
They look like the same car.
Right. Yeah. Same car. Like, you put a car cover on, it looks like the same car. But the
M4, the 4 Series doesn't even look like a BMW. Forget about not looking like a 3 Series. It doesn't even look like a BMW.
No.
It has no BMW styling cues. It's horrible.
It's not
absolutely
good.
Horrible.
So Zach, it's for Rated, right?
Right. Shot season 2 of Rated.
Right.
Yeah.
But we can talk about this car, right? It's a fucking M3, right? You don't have to like.
I'm not gonna like scoop myself.
It's not like
really.
Not scooping yourself. It's the M3. We've been talking about the M3. So you drove a combination that we haven't driven.
Right.
Sedan stick. How'd that go?
Sedan stick non-comp.
How did that go?
It has the attributes we liked from the sedan comp. It's like, this is the more usable car. Again, it's basically, in my opinion, like the new E39 M5, because that's about the size it is, and it's more usable. What I still don't understand, though, or like, is that the non-comps are just, they're too stiff to be really enjoyable, I think, dailies. Like, it's really focused, and the steering's really good, and all that shit, but they have the comp for that, so I wish the regular one was more comfortable and just less like locked down.
Oh, interesting. Camisa, how about this take? Back in the day in 06, when the V10 cars, the M5 and M6, were offered in both stick and single clutch shit pile, people like us who were working at the time said that the V10 engine was better paired with the paddles than it was with the manual. Time has really proven us wrong on that one. You think?
I disagree.
You disagree?
Yeah. Yeah, I've just driven them again recently, and the ratios on a 6-speed are way too widely spaced for that.
The paddles are fucking unusably bad. That single clutch is misery, and the resale values of a stick versus a fucking paddle car tend to agree with me on this one.
They are definitely rarer. I mean, remember, the manual is U.S. market only.
I know.
But I don't think it was, I think in terms of acceleration and raw performance, the SMG was better. I don't like that the early cars, manual cars, had non-defeatable stability control, which was Germany saying to the US market.
No, I forgot about that. I did not remember. You couldn't turn off the stability control in those cars?
Germany refused to put a manual in it. BMW NA fought with them. They did it.
Germany, they're a bunch of cockbags sometimes.
And you know that manual was just taken straight out of the 550i, so it really couldn't deal with the torque. And so they were like, okay, well, then we'll just, you know, make it so you can't abuse it, which is bullshit. So they fixed that towards the end. You can program them out anyway, but I still think the gearing was a better match for the engine. I would never have an SMG car, ever.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think, well, I suppose I didn't leave room for both to be true. The ratios of with 7 was better for that engine. And also, in hindsight, that was a terrible paddle-shifted gearbox that has not aged well. And if you drive one today, you'd probably rather have the stick if you had to have one or the other. Ratios be damned.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying is, even with that knowledge that both could be true, what will happen in 10 years? Because now we're saying, okay, comp with automatic is really the way to go. But in 10 years, we're going to be like, oh, it was really about the stick, and we didn't give it enough credit.
I don't particularly like that manual.
No,
I didn't either.
It won't be rushed on a shift. It's vague. It's, you know, typical BMW sort of 5 Series long throws that are rubbery and whatever, which, look, I've BMWs. I'm used to that. The problem was that there's so much lag on that engine that you don't notice it on the automatic because of the torque converter and because of the crazy short gear ratios. And so you go with longer gear ratio and a manual, and the engine just suddenly loses its urgency and starts to feel heavy, laggy, non-responsive. And the way the engine pulls doesn't really match the lack of urgency from the shifter. You can't just bah, bah, in the middle of a slide, you can't rush any shift. I really don't like the manual, which is hard to say.
Yeah, because you want to be team manuals no matter what.
But they're not all equal. I mean, it is a terrible shifting experience. Like compared to,
I wouldn't call it terrible, but it's definitely not top three or even top five.
No, not at all.
My original script, which is the line we had to cut for space, was that the manual was clearly designed by someone who's never driven a Honda, a Mazda.
Right.
The problem,
Zach and I got back to back that M4. With the stick and then the Civic Type R, right afterwards?
Yeah.
And it was like, oh boy. I forget which was which.
We had the Civic first. So we were like, ooh, deliciousness. And then we got in the M4 and...
Yeah, I mean, you drive a Civic Type R and you fuck with that shifter and you go, it's that or a Porsche. This is where we're at right now in terms of manuals.
Like the FRS has a nicer shifter than the M4.
Everything is a nicer shifter than the M3. Right. I mean... Here's the thing, BMW. I'm on the fence. Like, I want to criticize them for that manual, but I gotta give them props for actually doing it. Because remember, this is another U.S. market only. This is BMW North America pushing and saying you have to give it.
Not just doing a commercial at Thermal. You've seen the fucking commercial, the quote self-driving car commercial.
Yeah. We'll forget about that.
Yeah, he's not about that.
Yeah, forget about it.
That wasn't a bad commercial. That commercial was all right, right? I thought that was a pretty nice spot. No?
Here's the thing. Stop spending money on commercials and spend money on developing a new fucking manual.
Yeah.
Fair.
Yeah.
Fair.
This is where I have a problem with, like, I have a hard time beating them up. Because they did it. Like, Mercedes doesn't have a manual and everyone else is using their manual, but fucking put some money behind it.
I mean, that's a fair point. Although, in my defense, with saying the commercial is okay, developing and homologating a new manual transmission versus one day in a crane car at Thermal, it's not really on the same scale of budget.
Except that, take a page out of Andy Preuninger's book, what he did for the GT cars. So he invented a 911R. Yes. So he invented this car so he could, for the sole, and the GT4 as his sole vehicles to finance the development of a new manual transmission. And it made money. And then once the transmission's been developed, then you can trickle it down to the other regular models. And that's how GT3 Touring came to be. I mean, there's a way to do it. Unfortunately, Andy Preuninger is the head of GT cars in Germany, so he gets to do what he wants. And BMW North America is a subset of a German company, so they're automatically idiots, don't know what they're talking about, and Germany refuses to do what they want.
Do you think that BMW has a market that is as hungry for those kind of specialty cars that have amazing feel and stuff the way Porsche does? I mean, if Porsche comes out with a new GT or something, they're snapped up immediately.
But they didn't get there by accident.
No, I know they didn't.
Right. You know what I mean? The first GT3... was a really a new in 03 was really a new thing, and they sold, but it wasn't like there was some crazy waiting list for them like there is now, and you couldn't buy one if you wanted one.
Jason, didn't you say like they sold more than they expected to the point they wore the tooling out?
Yeah. So here's the thing: when you make a car that compelling and that good and that hits its target dead on every single fucking time, like GT cars does at Porsche. That's when you get the waiting list, because everyone knows the new one is going to be better than the old one and it's going to be epic and there's not going to be anything wrong with it.
Right.
BMW has had so many missteps with the M brand. I mean, let's talk about M5. Let's talk about last generation M3. That who the fuck would be on a waiting list for that? I mean, the only thing that sold out was M2 CS, and that's because we all knew it was going to be a better version of M2. But even last gen M4 GTS didn't sell worth a shit.
Yeah. Well,
I saw one at the track.
It just didn't seem like a value for money. Even when it was new, it didn't seem like it was going to be a value for money.
No, yeah. Now they're the same price as a regular M4.
Really? That's a fucking hit, really? Did they drop that much? Wow.
Ouch. The last time I looked was a year ago, but yeah, they were effectively the same price.
They might have gone back up now that we know how ugly the new one is. That's a thing that could happen.
Yeah, that's true. Because I think the F80 was very good looking.
Have you looked at the prices of GT3 Tourings? Not that you necessarily have, but they were 150, 140,000 8 months ago. Now, 225, 240 for low mileage Tourings. My suspicion is that people either are unsure how long it's going to take to get the new one, or they don't like how the new one looks and they want a Touring because they think it looks a little more restrained.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's my opinion.
Misha Mansoor is dancing right now.
I got multiple clients that bought Tourings in the last year that are fucking...
Yeah, multiple friends that sold their Tourings that are like...
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
thinking Spike, it was going to drop when the new one came out.
Yeah, yeah. Spike got out early, but that's okay. They did all right.
Jason, what did you think about the suspension ride of the Comp versus the Non? I'm curious.
I only drove the Comp on track. So I didn't really get a chance. But I'll be honest with you, I had the base car, and I drove it around sort of where I lived for a couple of days. Didn't bother me at all. It's firm, but this is the problem, is we expect certain level of performance from an M3, and there's going to be a compromise baked in.
Yeah.
The big issue with the car is that it's so big and so isolated that you then want the ride quality of an M5, and it's stuck in this netherworld between, like, should I be an M3, which is, you know, a track car, and or should I be a M5, which is a do-it-all Swiss Army knife that does everything better than everyone else. And I think BMW is stuck in there. They fucking nailed that chassis on track, though. Holy shit.
Yeah.
It's real fast in the canyons, too. We didn't have track time, but, I mean, up in the early, the wee hours of the morning when you have the road all to yourself, it is not slow at all.
Well, I drove the regular M3 at Palmer. Palmer just for, like, rules, some mounted shots. What a crazy
place. You ever
go
to Palmer, Camisa?
Dude.
What is Palmer?
I don't know. Motorsports. Palmer Motorsports Park. Ranch? Maybe. Park?
Park Ranch?
It's in Massachusetts.
Yep.
And it is built on the side of a mountain. It is one of the most fabulous places that you could film a television show. It has the craziest uphill S's that are perfect for toge-style drifting.
They have the most elevation change in a single corner in North America. It's like 500 feet or something ridiculous. Holy it really...
Dude, it literally... It could be Laguna with better branding and more parking. Huh. But it's got... It's just fucking... Oh, Zach's got some Imagerie. And I filmed a spot there years ago. The elevation... So if you're looking at this photo, Jason, the sort of infield section there is probably, 100 and something, 150 feet above that straightaway on the left. It's fucking high.
From the bottom straightaway all the way to that top section where, if you guys can see the mouse, that is several hundred feet. Absolutely.
Wow.
Like this left-hand corner is like a second or third gear corner. And there's so much camber in it, and you feel like you're driving up two stories. And what's crazy is a lot of the corners, Dai was like, dude, this is like surfing. Like, it's like, you know, angle. But there's a couple corners that go off camber in the middle of being on camber, and like, there's some real tricky shit in this thing.
And there's a lot of rock walls that you could hit.
Yeah, there's not a lot of runoff. I didn't fuck around out there. I was like, well, maybe I'll try to slide, and I looked around, I was like, nah, I'm just gonna
But if you want to film from a drone, I mean, there's nowhere like this to film from a drone.
And this is in Massachusetts?
It's in Palmer, Massachusetts. It's like an hour, 10 minutes from west of Boston.
190 feet of elevation. That's what it says on the top of the thing
right
there.
I thought
he said
it was like
190 feet of elevation. Well, that's just like at least, I think that's almost as much as Laguna.
I believe it is.
Oh, yeah, it is.
14 cambered corners. Yeah, is there an elevation map by chance on this fucking GeoCities website of theirs? It's fucking garbage. This website is such garbage. Racetrack and facilities map? Is that... That doesn't really have an elevation. Oh, here. It says on the facility map, it says 509 feet of elevation change. How do we calculate that?
Probably I think 190
is lowest to highest, and five whatever counts going up and then going back down.
Oh, okay. All right.
You know what I mean?
Maybe,
Total rise, right?
Total rise.
Okay, so
you go 100, you go down 100, you go another 100, that's...
Right, yeah. But if you're on, I cannot recommend this place highly enough if you want somewhere on the East Coast to film. It's so cool.
And
are the people who run it still cool?
It'd be gorgeous.
They were chill.
Yeah, the owner was real nice.
The people who run it were super chill.
The people that ran the facility were really cool.
Oh, that photo shows a good elevation there, yeah. So we could probably find other images that really accentuate There it is. That's the fucking shot. You see that, Camisa? Look
yeah,
at that.
Yeah, man.
It's pretty fun.
Isn't that epic?
190 feet.
I mean, it really is just built.
It reminds me of Club Motorsport in New Hampshire. It was sort of similar, sort of built in the side of a hill, which is another really cool track.
And then pull up, Zach, that picture of the GT3 on the bottom there, and it shows, just look at this. This is the pit road, and that's a fucking open rock wall.
Yeah, it's like they took a quarry and paved it, really.
So crazy.
That's awesome.
Yeah, this place rules. Let's see. What time you got to go? 10? You got 15 minutes?
All right, 15, yeah.
All right, let's
go. Sorry about the time constraints.
It's okay. It's a show. We'll have it. Let's go to the random. Do you want to do random car reviews? Do you have your spreadsheet handy?
I do.
All right.
I always do.
Do we have any?
Well, let's see. This guy throws out 666, 2019, 2 and 3.
Anyone over 5? Anyone? Any heavy hitters? Oh, here we go. We got a 10. Kevin, we'll start with $10. Kevin says number 1854 also requests an impression of the engine sound.
Uh-oh. Okay. 1854. That is. Oh, he really doesn't want to hear this. This is a 2015 Jeep Renegade 1.4 Sport.
You definitely have to make the engine sound. Is that the one multi-air? That's a Fiat yes, multi-air engine.
That
right?
is a single cam multi-engine, and the impression is something like, "Maw."
It goes.
All right, so I put. Yeah, exactly. All right. So 2015 Jeep, I put 22 miles on it on November 12, 2014 and said, lovely stick, clutch is impossible not to be smooth with, though it's definitely tough to take off without a ton of revs.
This was a manual?
Yeah, it was a manual.
They made a Jeep Renegade with a manual?
They did, but only with the 1.4.
Oh, I didn't even know that. Okay, sorry, go on. Yeah.
Lag plus lots of lag plus runs out of steam by $6,000, but this feels faster in everyday driving than the 2.4 Tiger Shark. And it sounds better and it's quieter too. Suspension feels considerably stiffer with some more short wheelbase pogo, but ultimately it's a comfortable, even in this basic trim. Stereo isn't particularly good and no backup camera, but fantastic on the back roads and more than nice enough at $23,000. Lovely little Jeep.
All right. That's not a terrible review.
That's not bad.
Not a bad review. That's all right. Zach, do you have any other numbers there? We've got Tyler says 2003.
Okay, let's see. Uh-oh, I have a lot, but this was...
Not the year, the actual number, yeah.
Yeah, no. This is a long one, but I'll truncate. So it's a 2016 Honda Civic Touring 1.5 Turbo that I drove September 19th of 2015, put 52 miles on it. And my first words, holy shit, this car is slow off the line. long initial gear ratio in the CVT plus tremendous lag equals nothing until you're going 15 miles an hour. Then it's mildly well coordinated for not going on. I don't know what that even means. It fakes just when it shouldn't, blah, blah, blah. Autonomous brake knows somebody's coming, flashes at you, but doesn't brake, which is stupid. Well isolated engine mooing, but it's quiet enough on the road.
Mooing?
There's the engine impression of the first one. No bumps on the route. I suspect this will be a rattle trap elsewhere because there was no bumps on the route. Nav screen never came on. It was pretty horrible when it buzzed. Way too complicated for use there with some redundant controls. Nice backseat and trunk. A lovely car, but not a Golf. So no car of the year, but very good. Oh, so this was in the middle of a car of the year comparison. But I got 36.6 indicated miles per gallon, beating the shit out of it.
All right.
So,
Scouting for Zen says, a question and a number. When you guys review cars, how do you decide if an issue is too nitpicky to be worth mentioning? And also number 1337. But for me, if there's something that that I find like annoying, but it's annoying because I, as a reviewer, haven't set the car up for myself.
Mm-hmm.
Like if the car has like 36 presets available and to go through those presets on the radio is very easy and seamless and great, but like the actual scrolling is a little clunky, but like I'm not going to sit there and set 36 presets, but like it's like, am I experiencing this issue because I'm not trained in this car or not setting it up fully for myself, that's kind of when I don't mention
Right. Is it annoying to us because we haven't set it up, but would it be convenient if we did set it
right.
up?
Yeah. That kind of thing.
If it will be an ongoing nuisance to a buyer, then yeah, if it's included.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm with you there. I mean, and personal preference got to come out of it. Like, oh, you know, this seat's not comfortable for me. Well, tough. Or, you know, I prefer shift paddles on the column. That's got to come out. But it's only when it would be a relevant ongoing problem for a buyer, and especially one that they might not notice on a test drive.
Yeah.
Something that, you know, you see after you're in the car for four hours, you start to notice like this. This is a recurring issue.
So. Yeah. We were talking about Ferrari SF90 last week because we were driving that thing and it's, you know, 700 grand and all.
The capacitive touch controls on the.
Bro.
How do I guess? I guess. Roma's the same way. So the only one I've driven with that interior is Roma. And every 2 seconds, it's like screaming at me in Italian. Ciao, vaffanculo. Yeah. Like whatever it is. And I don't even know what the fuck it's saying.
Yeah.
But it's constantly asking me for something because I'm constantly hitting the little voice button on the
screen. Because you're just grazing it with your thumb in the normal course of driving.
It was stupid.
Yeah, it's a good thing they don't have to give people test drives in those before they're buying them because they're not going to figure out.
They probably pulled a fuse from the stereo speaker so they don't keep hearing the thing go, bong, what do you want? Bong, what do you want? Bong.
Yeah, it's absolutely, here's something I don't want in my 1,000 horsepower car, buttons I can't feel.
Sudden distractions.
Or any car for that matter. Yeah. Like, I don't want hidden buttons.
Yeah, I rode in like Road and Track. I was like, it's bad enough at the pace of Escalade. Forget the pace of this fucking thing. You know what I mean? Yeah. 1337, please.
This is a treat. 1987 Bertone X19.
Oh, hell yeah.
$7,000 bought this 60,000 mile example. I'm going to buy one too then. Slow but really charming, far better than I remember and better than I expected. I had no idea it was so quiet, smooth, rigid, rode so well, and the engine was so willing. Just a nice, smooth, easy car to drive. I'm wholly impressed. I'm not always miserable.
That was good.
That car got a negative 5 from you.
Yeah,
that's very nice.
Yeah. Right. There's a guy who's doing K24 swaps in them things too, and apparently they're just really fucking good time.
If I remember correctly, you know, like I don't remember writing that, but I just thought, wow, it's smooth and quiet. I just want a cammy high revving engine because I don't think it revs all that particularly high. And I like angry, shitty engines rather than smooth, nice ones.
It would be a good car to do a fucking motorcycle swap. Like, you know those BMW bikes, like the K1600? Yep. It's like the 1.6 six-cylinder engine.
Yep.
Like, imagine that in a fucking Miata or in the back of one of those fucking.
I literally had this conversation yesterday about that. What's the, I always forget the name of it, the Honda, is it CBR?
Oh, CBX, CBX.
CBX. That motor, because it sounds like an F1 car.
Yeah.
In a Miata. I just had this conversation with yesterday.
Well, yeah. I mean, a modern version of that would be the BMW K1600, which is a 1.6 liter, six cylinder, transversely mounted. Straight six on a fucking bike, and they're selling that now. You could pull that out and put that in the middle of a Bertone X19 and have, I think it makes like 175 horsepower. The thing would fucking move. It would.
It's twice the original power.
That would be awesome. Crazy. You could have a sequential gearbox with rev matching. It would be awesome.
Get a little electric motor for reverse. That'd be sick.
Yeah. There you go. Have you ever driven a car with a motorcycle engine in it? It's way more fun than you think it would be.
I drove a T-Rex with that engine in it.
Oh yeah.
That was the only thing.
How was that?
But never a car. It was kind of cool. I mean, three wheels are a pain in the ass because you hit everything in the road. You can't miss a pothole.
Right.
And I did learn that during skid pad testing that motorcycles don't experience lateral G forces. And so I blew the motor.
Get the fuck out of here.
I mean, it pulled like 0.78 or something, and then pop.
0.78, dude? Oh, my God. Imagine buying something that looks kind of like a sports car and sounds like that, but if you pull 0.78 Gs, you fucking starve the motor.
Well, the other thing is that no one's really going to do that long of a car. I mean, I did a full lap, and then I saw an oil pressure light and stopped, and it was already too late. But you're not – that's a long, you know, a 300-foot diameter skid pad. It's kind of a long turn. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, Thunder Hill, for example, has a – corner turn two is like that, so I mean it can happen on a racetrack, but chances are you're not going to do that on the street.
I don't think that's what T-Rex's target market is, but
But
no, I had a go in one of these Honda N600s once that had a VFR 800 motorcycle engine in it with a shaft drive to a rear differential. It was rear wheel drive, but it had the motorcycle gearbox with paddles installed, and it revved to 12,800 RPM sounded like a Formula One car, and it was absolutely off the fucking wall. I mean, it was the coolest. There it is. Yep, Zach's got it. That little fucker really
That's
would put
awesome.
That thing will put some fucking hair on your nuts.
It sounded so
gnarly. Where's the hood? Is the hood up on anything? No, no hood up. There's my video. We could play it because we own the rights. But go check out the. I have a video of it if you give a shit. It just sounds insane. Dude, your show Icons, one of your multiple shows on Haggerty.
It's
is what day? What fucking day is Icons come out?
Thursday. Thursday is Jason Day on the Haggerty YouTube channel, and I'm this week is yesterday was dark, but it's a combination of Know It All, Revelations, and Icons. So this coming Icons on the M3 comes out a week from yesterday, so June 10th. I think that is. And then we're dark for another week, and then there's a Know It All, and then the second quarter finally closes. So I'm halfway through my year. Here's the problem. Haggerty, my boss at Haggerty, super cool guy. He should know better. He asked me during a pandemic lockdown what I could possibly do. And I was like, yes, everything, all of it. And now
you have to.
Month off.
Yeah.
You know, 40 pieces of content as a one-man band, so to speak, is a lot.
Well, especially if their films as produced as that fucking BMW thing, which is a lot of I just the whole time watching that, I was like, am I expected to live up to this level of production on this Haggerty shit? Is this is crazy.
That was so Icons is insane. I mean, my goal with Icons is to beat Top Gear, when Top Gear was at its best.
Well, that intro shot is right fucking there. Yeah. I mean, if you obviously you don't have enough money to do some of their craziest stuff, like when they did the SLR camera array to do the Matrix shots and shit, like we're not doing that. But what you did in that intro sequence is using conventional resources as good as you'll find fucking anywhere.
Well, I think what Top Gear also did really well, as we know from talking to Chris or other people, is they write the fuck out of it. Like they write, rewrite. They'll have lunch, they'll rewriting at the same time. So like the tightness of the words and the story, and then like you can have the arc that you've planned, and then
storyboarded. That shit is there.
That's what I'm saying is like, I think what I always appreciate about Top Gear was how it had this arc. And then I think Jason's stuff has always had that. So, you know, you may not be able to beat them in terms of effects, but you can be just as good in terms of what you're saying.
Our budget, I guarantee you my budget for that entire episode of Icons, which again, 30 minutes long, was less than their catering budget for one day on a shoot.
It probably was.
Without question.
And I know, because I have a show on Haggerty as well called Modified. Did you happen to see my new episode, Jason? The Drift Hummer?
I did not see wasn't that one that you put in the title, like how to unfuck up or
how to unshitbox a Hummer H1? Because a Hummer H1 is in a rare class of vehicles that's like virtually impossible. You know, unshitboxing is very expensive. If a car came off the line a shitbox, chances are it's a shitbox forever. And John Ward at Icon won't even touch Hummers. and so
these guys in there, wait a second. Okay, anyway.
These guys in Detroit, you know, they have unshitboxed the Hummer in a certain sense. So they have a street build that's like, you know, 300 grand and has a modern powertrain and all kinds of cool shit in it. But they also have this mule, like the 911R mule that Preuninger had, that it was a military windowless, doorless, roofless, the lightest Hummer you can. And it turns out that, you know, Hummer's mid-engined. Right. And if you set it up for rear drive and you lower it, even leaving the portal axles, you can lower it, you can put big brakes on it, and you can put street wheels and tires on it. So this thing has a Duramax, 850 horsepower Duramax, 1300 pounds of torque, automatic paddle shifter, Allison gearbox, automatic, a 6-speed Allison, selectable fore and rear wheel drive, and it's fully mid engine. 50-50 front rear distribution.
That's amazing.
and it's 9 fucking feet wide. It turns in. It turns in like a fucking 488. It's crazy.
Dude,
I drifted the entire fucking bowl of a half mile oval.
I just saw the screenshots of it. That's insanity.
It is the fucking tits. Maybe Zach can show 8 seconds of footage and we won't get flagged by YouTube if we show it like in the background. I mean, it's just...
Oh, my God.
It's just the silliest... I mean, it was really shockingly easy. And you just dance it on the nose and fucking chuck it, and it's fucking...
It's funny right there. You watch you brake and you watch the wheels lock up because there's so much mass, but the brakes are really strong. It's like, and then it starts to slide.
Inboard brakes.
So I'm guessing
brakes.
It doesn't have ABS.
It has inboard 10-piston brakes.
Oh, my God.
And they cut it. It weighs 5,200 pounds, which for a Hummer is nothing.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's on my show, Modified on Haggerty. It's very fun.
We are coworkers, aren't we?
Sort of.
Yeah. I mean, technically.
We're remote coworkers like everybody else right now.
Yeah, like everyone. Yeah. At least I've met you in person. I haven't met any of the actual, like any of my Haggerty bosses or anything in person yet.
When are you coming to LA soon?
I was just there a couple weeks ago. I tend to pop in and pop out. But
all right, well, let us know ahead of time next time. Because last time I saw you on a Sunday with no fucking notice and it was bullshit.
That's right. I did see you. Yeah, it was, but it was there. A friend of mine's having a nervous breakdown. He was like, hey, can you come and watch me have a nervous breakdown? Which is what I did, which is like, just, you know, if for the record, if you have a friend who's having a nervous breakdown, all you do is just come there and make like dick jokes and make them laugh. And that's the only thing you can do.
Yeah.
You couldn't take 2 hours out of that for a podcast, you know, just leave your friend alone to go see other people. I'm sure he would have taken it.
Don't leave people alone in the middle of a nervous breakdown, Zach. What a good friend you are, though.
Hey, man, I just think everybody's at a negative 20 until they prove otherwise, you know? So fuck everybody.
It's negative 20. It's negative 9. What did I say earlier? I don't know. Make the shit up as I go on.
All right, dude. Well, have a good conference call or whatever it is you got to go do at 10:01. Thank you for the hour. Always great radio.
Thanks for having me on the show. It's always fun. Yep. I will come down to LA and I'll be in person and we can cough on each other like the good old days.
Have good butter there. Exactly. Jason Camisa on Instagram, and of course all of his shows are on the Haggerty YouTube channel, so go give them a watch. This BMW / Mercedes film that he did is fucking good.
Yeah,
really, really good. I would be very proud of it if I was him. Thanks you. Buddy, we'll see you later.
All right, I'll see you guys soon.
Kick his ass out of this bitch, Zach. Because we're going to keep doing a show for a little bit, I guess, right?
Oh, yeah.
Should we just keep doing a show?
Yeah, let's
bye,
keep
Jason.
Going for a little bit.
Send that motherfucker off.
Goodbye. I'm just going to sit here until he actually kicks me off.
Yeah, I've been waiting for his fingers hovering on the button.
I've never left the room while we're broadcasting live, so let's see what happens.
Really?
I can also.
Well, it's just fucking bye.
We left.
It worked. Should we, because my dad is coming in tomorrow, should we do questions now or should we talk about the Land Cruiser that I was driving or the Targa Heritage or any of those things?
Well, I think we have choices. We could do a question show now or we could save the questions for a show next week when I'm back and we record, and then we could talk about the cars you've been driving.
I don't know. Is the Land Cruiser or the Targa Heritage interesting?
I mean,
I went off-roading the Land Cruiser up the trail that everyone was like, oh, you should really be taking like Subaru Outbacks up that. And by the way, I damaged the Land Cruiser doing that trail.
The one we normally do?
Yeah.
Oh.
I took the hard line that I took in the Defender, not the easy line.
Yeah.
I was like, this is the Land Cruiser. Hard line. There was two places where I got stuck, and there was one place where I dinged it up a little bit, reversing out of that trouble and getting back to where I could go.
There's a couple sections there that, I mean, as you proved in the G-Wagon when you did two wheels back and forth,
right,
like that, an Outlander would have trouble in that.
Oh, for sure.
Area.
So off-road videos do not do justice to the steepness and severity of either trails or obstacles.
Yeah.
I mean, they just don't. You know, you can't... you can't look at a world that requires not just dimensionality, but like pitch and stuff like that through a lens that is a fucking half a centimeter across, you know, on a GoPro, it doesn't provide a real accurate picture.
That's why so much of, like, when Top Gear would do off-road videos, much of the, like, action is them bouncing around in the car versus a shot outside the car.
Right. I mean, it's just, it's that particular trail, which I have to, like, qualify this every time, is I don't think it's the hardest trail I could find anywhere ever, but it's the hardest trail I really, really believe anyone with a stock vehicle would reasonably attempt.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anyone's buying a G-Wagon and going fucking super bouldering in it. I really don't. Yeah,
almost zero people.
And so this is like the hardest, this is a tough trail for a stock vehicle. Like nothing has made it up like crazy easy. Like the Defender did a great job. The G-Wagon did a great job. Mm-hmm. But like the Defender, I took like the hardest line. You know, I gave it a challenge and it was a little bit of a challenge. Like if you took one of these Outback like wilderness things, like the new one, and you tried to pick the easiest line everywhere you could go, there would only be one or two places where you'd struggle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Alternatively, if you pick the hardest line at every opportunity, like I did with the Land Cruiser, there's multiple places that you're going to have a really tough time. And there, I found two places where I could not proceed, and I had to back up.
Wow.
And
was it a clearance issue or a grip
issue? It was a combination of very aggressive articulations combined with sand. Okay. It was a sandy articulation where I just and it was just
we're not getting
out of that. So not forward anyway. So I had to reverse out and I was fully by myself. Like you probably shouldn't do that by yourself. Like period. Just for like there's cell service up there. If there was an emergency, like I could have called anybody if I had to, but just like. I don't know. There's only so far I'm willing to push myself when I'm by myself.
Totally.
You know what I mean? So
and you're pushing a vehicle that you're not super familiar with.
Right.
And, you know, if you have to back up in
really
an awkward situation.
Like I'm making excuses. But ultimately, I did damage the vehicle a little bit making this video. And it did have a tough time on this trail.
Well, I think 98% of the driving we do, the cars we review are street cars.
Right.
You know, high-performance street cars. That's kind of what we do. We go off-roading a couple times a year. We do these trails when we get the right cars for it. But, like, I'm definitely not saying I'm anywhere near even, like, a blue belt in off-roading. Like, I'm pretty green to it, and I like to be careful, and you do too. So we have to protect the car, protect ourselves, and we are kind of like the normal buyer, actually. Like, we're the person, you know, who would buy this thing, and they maybe go up one trail now and then. So we want to be careful.
Like, and the Land Cruiser, like, I would buy something like that if I really had to drive on horrible roads or, like, in really bad weather or on a lot of fire roads. Like, I think this trail is a little more than I would want a stock Land Cruiser for.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, those fire roads getting between the paved road and the base of that trail where you've got to drive, like, a half hour on fairly rutted up, you know, fire roads, the Land Cruiser was fabulous. You know what I mean? If I lived my life on fire roads, fucking Land Cruiser.
Right.
Or sand, you know what I mean? Or snow. It wouldn't necessarily be my first choice for real articulation. It also wouldn't be, I really didn't like driving it that much on anything resembling a curvy road. The steering is horrible.
Does it feel like...
I love the engine, but...
I mean, weren't the old ones, though, amazing at off-roading and articulation and everything? Have they changed stuff, or...
I mean, I don't know. I mean, look, so if I say it's not amazing, someone's going to say I'm doing it wrong.
Hmm.
So,
okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So maybe I was doing it wrong. Maybe I didn't put it in exactly the right fucking setting or whatever. Maybe the fact that I was trying to make a video while do this shit in real time, you know, maybe I just didn't stop to think of something and whatever. You know, I had this experience. It is recorded on video.
Mm-hmm.
I did my best. And the place where I got, where I couldn't proceed, if it wasn't a sandy articulation, it would have proceeded. It wasn't the articulation that stopped. It was a combination of articulation and then not having a good surface on where the wheel that had the grip was.
Right.
So that was where I ended up with a problem.
Okay.
you know, it wasn't the end of the world. It just meant I had, all right, let me back up and go this way instead. You know what I mean?
What tires were on it?
Dunlop something or others. I can't remember. They were Dunlops, but I cannot remember the exact.
Like, were they super knobby or were they not super
knobby? No, okay. they were an all-terrain, all-season. They weren't too loud on the highway. They were. I mean, the car, it had a nice ride, obviously. Mm-hmm. And being a Land Cruiser, it was exceptionally, you know, it's got Lexus levels of quality with a Toyota badge on it, right? Right. You get inside and it feels like a Lexus. It doesn't feel like a Toyota. And it's built on that level that a high-end Lexus would be built on. The multimedia system is multiple generations behind. You know, but there's a lot of utility. There's places to store stuff. There's places to plug shit in. It's got a third row now. I didn't have the that's the Heritage, the one you're showing mm-hmm. there with the cool wheels. I just had the regular, the base one. But it's I wouldn't be surprised if all the media photos are Heritage.
Oh, gosh. Gotcha. Okay.
This thing had like 7,000 miles on it. It was definitely the last Land Cruiser left in the press fleet. That white one there on the right, mine was not that color, but that was basically it. It was the basic one. But I think it's one thing if I was viewing it in the lens of here's a truck from 2014 with 40,000 miles on it that I'm buying at a bit of a discount, and that durability is really going to be the virtue for me. Mm-hmm. Then I think you can see the value in something like that because it's a fucking tank. You know what I mean? But like, to go, okay, this is $90,000 almost, you know, in 2021. Wow. And it feels really trucky, you know. Like, even the G-Wagon has, like, good steering now.
Yeah,
you know what
true.
I mean?
Yeah.
Like, the Defender, I think, was legitimately better off-road. I mean, straight up, I would go to the mat and say that on the same trail that I was on, roughly identical conditions, the Defender got up that trail easier than the Land Cruiser.
Is there a weight difference between them that you know of?
The Defender's got to be lighter.
Okay.
I mean, the Land Cruiser's 5,800 pounds. The Defender's got to be lighter. The Defender's way faster. Like, if you drag raced them, I had the six cylinder. I think that's the 400. And I like the Defender's steering a lot better.
Yeah, the Defender's 5,000 pounds.
Yeah, 800 pounds lighter. Okay. That's a big difference.
For sure.
You know, so, you know, it's not, it's, if you're, but if you compartmentalize the Land Cruiser into, here is the most durable passenger vehicle that a company known for durable vehicles can build. That's what you're paying for.
Yeah. You know? I saw an auction a few days ago. They're selling a 6-year-old Land Cruiser for $60,000.
So like, that's the other thing is if you do both sides of the math, you know, a Land Cruiser is really expensive to get into one. But if you look at the resale, you know, it's not very expensive to own.
Right.
Driving a Land Cruiser for 6 years to take a $20,000 depreciation on what was probably a $75,000 truck, that's fabulous.
Yeah.
They're
like Wranglers.
There's very few cars that are really nice cars that depreciate. Because remember, nice cars fucking depreciate faster.
Right, right, right.
A basic Camry is going to hold its value better than an AMG or a new Bentley or something like that.
Yeah.
So for a luxury vehicle to hold that kind of value is fabulous, you know. But it didn't inspire me really at all.
Okay.
So, and obviously durability is not a virtue when you've got a car for a week.
Yeah, we have to like assume.
Right.
You know,
we understand.
Which
it.
We do, right. Yeah. We're like, okay, well, this should work for mm-hmm. a very long time, which is a strong attribute for any of the
right.
Japanese manufacturers, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're ending production of the Land Cruiser, but if you read all the releases, they sort of leave the door open that they might bring it back, you know, in some other future generation. So
I mean, anytime they've ended anything, just look at the Wikipedia for any car ever, and it's like they take a 2-year break, and then they develop it, and then do another one.
Yeah.
You know, because if there's the market's there, the brand cachet is there, and they just take a break, and then they re-engineer the whole thing.
Yeah. Hmm. But it was pretty much what you'd expect, but it drives like an older car for
so
sure.
Is there a $90,000 Range Rover that competes with it that you would prefer one to the other?
Well, you know, it's not like what maintenance costs and stuff aren't a real thing. But
right.
If they weren't a real thing, yeah, I'd much rather have a Range Rover, a basic full-size Range Rover, a very nice sport, or even possibly, I don't want a $90,000 Defender, but yeah, I'd rather have a Range Rover for every day. Yeah, it's a much nicer driving vehicle, even if you don't get a really fast one. It's like, oh, this can do the off-roady shit, but it knows
it
that
feels
I...
feels like a luxury knows, yeah. car in every kind of input and interaction. Yeah.
Like, I have some friends who live in Mexico, like in Puerto Vallarta, where it's a nice place. You know, it's a nice place for them to live. They got a nice house. But, like, the roads in Puerto Vallarta are pretty shit. They're concrete slabs. Their expansion joints are fucking horrible. The maintenance isn't so great. They roll a fucking Land Cruiser, and it's, like, the perfect car for that.
Right.
You know? And so that's, like, if that's your shit, you know what I mean? Or if it's, like, your mountain house, your Montana house, your farm, you know, out somewhere, your house up in a mountain, up a mile and two dirt roads, the conditions variable, you never know, that kind of thing. That. It's great for that.
Mm-hmm. You know? And for someone like that, there are more Toyota dealerships, you know, in the world than there are Range Rover dealerships.
True.
So parts are a thing, et cetera, et cetera.
The only thing preventing my mother from buying a Range Rover for the last 10 years is that the only dealership around where they live, which is Greenwich, Connecticut, fucking ritzy-ass town, there's two dealerships 25 miles either way from where they live, and they're both horrific.
Wow.
Horrific. And so that's literally why she hasn't gotten a Range
Rover. You think they'd be really nice dealerships, considering, like, the area is very nice.
You'd think, but they're like grandfathered in, dude. Sometimes it's
like you want to buy one?
When you're Porsche, you can force your dealers to renovate their shit.
Mm.
When you're like JLR,
right?
Not so much. There's like different agreements. Well, I'm friends with a family that has been in the Porsche Audi sales business in the Northeast for multiple generations, and you know they talk about this, how not only when a new car comes out, you know, when Taycan came out, they had to have a service bay for Taycan, you know what I mean, and train a technician, blah blah blah. You know, when certain special models come out, when the R8 came out, okay, now we need to know how to service this R8 in a special way, here's the special tools, and et cetera. And some of that, sometimes it's, you know, every 10 years the corporate makeover of the showroom, and you know, and that's a pain in the ass if you own a dealership. So I sympathize with a family owned business that has to spend millions of dollars, but at the same time, when they don't have those types of standards, you end up with a structure of, well, the car's really nice, but I don't want to deal with that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's true. That was a big thing with, I think, Kia and Hyundai, like,
sure,
in the early
Genesis
in the 90s.
Yeah, and then they had to,
like, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then they revised everything and make the
Volkswagen
experience really
Phaeton.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, they separated it. They said, you have to do what Lexus does.
Right.
You know, what Lexus did, just, you know, move the whole thing, have them go to their own place.
Yeah, you have to do a good job in that place. You can't just separate it.
Right.
Because if, like you said, if people have a shitty experience, they don't want to go back. It's like a bad restaurant.
Nothing. There was nothing like Lexus service departments in the 90s. Open till midnight.
Wow.
Lexus of Greenwich, open till midnight 5 days a week.
Jeez.
Open 7 days a week at service department, but open till midnight 5 days. I mean, that's just
making
fucking
a strong push.
I mean, and they'd give, like they had a 50 loaner cars, always getting the nice new loaners. I mean, they had it locked.
Targa?
So the Targa Heritage Edition, it was, you know, there's not much to report about it in terms of here's the new shit. It's fundamentally an appearance package, special colors, special gold badges, which I fucking love. I wore my gold porn star watch with the gold one, the gold badges, and a corduroy interior.
Really?
Yes.
Whoa.
Go to my older post from a few days before about the car. Keep going there, right side. There's a photo. I don't know if it's going to come through in the photo, but the seats, the centers are if you zoom in, I think there's a corduroy shot of the pattern. Yeah, see? It is real badass.
It probably feels really comfortable,
it's
right?
It's very comfortable. And so what I thought was interesting about it, and what I talk about in the video, and I'm going to talk about now, is going back to this soft, heavy, super luxury spec 992 after spending a week with the GT3.
Mm-hmm.
And I really appreciated the spread. You know what I mean? The GT3 is like fucking race car. Yeah. And this thing is like the best, just the best daily. I mean, it's the seats are so comfortable and the suspension like absorbs all kinds of shit. The steering is, you know, relaxed on the street, but you fucking huck it in the corner and you know what it goes. Got tons of grip. You know, it's all-wheel drive, and it's a Targa, so it's heavy. But on the highway, you know, the heaviness and the rubber in the suspension, it's not spherical bushings. You know, it's a very fast luxury car. It just, you know, it's obviously not as raw as the GT3, but, you know, down, I mean, I was up on Lake Hughes Road, fucking, we were mobbing, you know, and Lake Hughes Road is very bumpy.
Yeah.
If you watch my Skyline episode of Modified, you know, but in this, you didn't hear any of that, and you certainly didn't feel it.
Wow, that's impressive.
And you know those yumps on Lake Hughes? Like, this road has certain corners where if your suspension is not fucking nailed, this thing will send you into the other lane, practically. Your ass will come off the seat, smash your head on the roof, and your car will be in the other lane. This thing, just right over it, on power. I mean, the grip is just so nice, but it's also just, like, so comfortable too, yeah. And relaxing, and you know, you don't, you know, the GT3 steering is really like when you want to fucking, it's like there's nothing like it. I mean, that's crazy, but and this is more relaxed than that, but you can still go, and you'll see it in the video, fucking fast. I mean, really, really fast. Anytime you want to go really, really fast,
of course, because it's still a Porsche, it still has a good engine, it's still focused enough.
Yeah,
I think this. To kind of go back to the M3 thing, part of the problem is that our roads are so fucked up here. So, like, the regular M3 I thought was too stiff. And it's like, well, it's just because we have so many cracks and things that you hear and feel. And so if a car like this, like the Targa, can dampen that out so you don't feel it, it's like that's the kind of sporting luxury experience
right.
I think I was hoping for. But maybe, as Jason said, that is more suited for the M5. But it's because in L.A., you know, the roads are really broken up.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the what we test them on. So yeah. We feel those kinds of things.
So when you've got a car that can really handle very well, but just glide over that, it's just so nice.
Right, it's really impressive.
And you know, I had Christian James Hand in the Targa video with me, featuring. He doesn't say much. I wanted him to be a little more vocal than he was, but that's okay. Mm-hmm. He does chime in when prompted. And we both agree that if you wanted a Porsche for the weekend, obviously the GT3 is where it's at. But it does not get much better for a daily than with that Targa. It's the shit, and it's very expensive. It's $195,000, but that's with the heritage stuff on it. You know, a regular Targa, you can have it for $150,000, and you can have the same level. You know, you can get a convertible. It's still very well insulated for, you know, $125,000. You can You can get right there.
Is this just a little bit quieter inside with the top up than the convertible is?
A little bit. It's only a little bit, and that's because the convertible is particularly well insulated, not because the Targa isn't good.
Gotcha. You know?
But we have to end the show. I have a hard out, unfortunately, for a doctor's appointment, but that's been fun with Camisa, and we caught us up, and if you have questions that are lingering from the Super Chat, we will have a Q&A show that we'll answer those questions next week.
Saved
tomorrow, Saturday, what is it, the 5th? This is tomorrow, yeah. My dad, Roger Farah, is going to be finally doing the business show with us. He's here visiting from New York this week, and he agreed to come do some radio with us and talk about his career, which is fucking insane. He was the CEO of Saks Fifth Avenue at 33 years old in 1987.
At 33?
33.
This is going to be a great show for feeling like an underachiever.
Yeah. And so in the age of, like, you know, young new tech CEOs being in their 30s, it might be something that people aren't really used to. But, like, a department store, the department store chain in the 80s, you know, when department store chains were at their boomiest, you know, my father was a 33-year-old CEO. At Saks Fifth Avenue, and he managed to go uphill from there. So he's run some of the largest fashion companies in the world, and he just retired like 5 months ago, having helped organize and execute the largest retail acquisition in history, selling Tiffany as the chairman of the board to LVMH.
And people, you know, for several years now, people have asked to have Roger on the show. Like people that are either business people or young people, whatever. Like the guy is full of wisdom. He's super smart and fascinating.
Yeah.
And so people have been like, hey, can we learn more stuff and, you know, hear some things?
Well, but now he's actually retired. So now he doesn't have to like answer to other people or shareholders or anything. So he can actually, you know, talk about, you know, things.
Yeah.
So that's tomorrow. And we have to end the show now. But thank you for listening. And we'll see you guys later. Bye.